Last year, all the evidence was that someone inside Hogwarts was trying to kill you, Harry, said Sirius impatiently. This year, we know that there's someone outside Hogwarts who'd like to kill us all. So I think learning to defend yourselves properly is a very good idea.
Welcome to the Basic Cinephile Podcast, Season 1, Harry Potter. Everyone, I'm your host, Sienna.
And I'm your other host, Adelia. This season on the Basic Cinephile Podcast, we are reading all of the Harry Potter books and watching all of the Harry Potter movies. And this week we are kicking off episode 10 with the fifth book, The Order of the Phoenix.
This podcast contains spoilers. This book has been out for 19 years, so we don't feel bad spoiling anything and everything about it. But if at this exact moment you have decided to dive into this magical world, pause the episode and go read all the books and binge all the movies, because who knows how many books and movies we will end up referencing in this episode.
So Voldemort is back, Death Eaters have broken out of Azkaban, and Harry is at Privet Drive feeling more isolated than ever. After a traumatic end to his school year, Harry is desperate for any kind of news regarding Voldemort's return, which he does not receive from Ron, Hermione, or Sirius, and the Muggle news isn't any more helpful.
It has been an uneventful summer, up until Harry and his cousin Dudley are attacked by Dementors in the middle of a Muggle neighborhood. Luckily for them both, Harry's really good with the Patronus charm. Unluckily for Harry, he performed underage sorcery and now has a hearing at the Ministry of Magic.
After literally no information, Harry is blindsided when he finds out that he's been being watched over 24/7 by members of the Order of the Phoenix, and that for the rest of the holidays, he will be living at the Secret Society's headquarters, based out of Sirius's childhood home. While there, Harry learns that Voldemort is after a weapon that he didn't have before, but that's as much information that is deemed appropriate for a 15-year-old to know.
Upon arriving at Hogwarts, Harry and company are troubled to see that the new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher is the same horrible Ministry of Magic employee that was at Harry's trial, Dolores Umbridge. And Umbridge takes no time at all to show how morally corrupt she is. And after a few sessions of writing lines with his own blood in detention, Harry is easily persuaded by Hermione to be the teacher of a secret club dedicated to learning defensive magic called Dumbledore's Army.
As the year progresses, Harry is becoming increasingly more temperamental. The workload is insane, his reputation has been trashed by the media and ministry, he has two teachers insistent on making his life awful, Dumbledore is avoiding him, and he keeps having these dreams of a hallway ending in a locked door.
But when Harry dreams of becoming a snake and attacking Mr. Weasley in front of that same locked door, he realizes that what he saw was real. Aware of what this means, Dumbledore assigns Snape to teach Harry how to close off his mind to the Dark Lord through occlumency lessons, which is pretty much torture for both Snape and Harry. After multiple failed attempts and a dive into one of Snape's most painful memories, the lessons end abruptly, and Harry is back to dreaming of the door.
Through questionable methods, the newly appointed High Inquisitor, Dolores Umbridge, finds out about Dumbledore's army, and finally has the evidence they need to remove Dumbledore from his post as headmaster. With Umbridge in charge, Hogwarts is a pretty grim place. Trelawney and Hagrid have been sacked, and it's time for the fifth years to take their OWLs.
Harry finds his mind wandering from the History of Magic exam and into the mind of Lord Voldemort, walking to that locked door. Except this time, he gets in, and to Harry's horror, Sirius is being tortured. Harry and a ragtag group of Dumbledore's army dash off to the Ministry of Magic on Thestrals, intent on saving Sirius. But when they arrive, they discover that Sirius isn't there, and they've fallen into Voldemort's trap.
Voldemort has been trying all year to get a prophecy from the Department of Mysteries, but learned the hard way that he and Harry are the only ones who are able to retrieve it, because the prophecy is about them. Voldemort used the vision of Sirius to lure Harry, and when he arrives, a group of Death Eaters are waiting for him. But they soon find out that Dumbledore's army won't go down without a fight.
Thanks to all their secret lessons from Harry, they are able to hold off the Death Eaters until the Order of the Phoenix arrives. Dumbledore himself shows up, but it's too late. Bellatrix Lestrange murders Sirius, Harry and Neville break the prophecy, and Voldemort tries to kill Dumbledore and flees. The Ministry of Magic can no longer deny that Voldemort is back, and Dumbledore can no longer hide his secret from Harry. The prophecy may have been smashed, But Dumbledore knows what is said, and with a heavy heart, he tells Harry of his fate. He is destined to either kill Voldemort or be killed by him. The second war has officially begun.
So, in rereading it, how did you like it?
Oh my god, okay. I loved it.
I mean, it's always been my favorite book, so.
I loved it. It has never been my favorite book. I remember, this is the book that I read the fastest, which is ironic because it's also the longest book in the series. It took me 2 days. I distinctly remember, like, reading through this whole thing and liking it, but afterwards being like, oof, that wasn't my favorite. And now I think I know why. It's because this book is so infuriating.
Mm-hmm.
And that's intentional, but it was like, it was so frustrating to me before. And this time I loved it. You get so much backstory.
You get so much backstory, which is exactly why I loved it.
Yeah.
But I do agree, it is absolutely infuriating.
Dolores Umbridge is such a punk, and she is, I mean, again, she's designed to be that way because she's under everyone's skin, and the only people that are excited to have her at Hogwarts are Malfoy and his friends and Filch.
Yeah, so that's not really the crowd that you want you around.
No, it's not. She is so frustrating because she is, I mean, she's a liar. She's a gaslighter. She is manipulative.
She's so prejudiced.
She's, oh my god, she's racist. She is
classist. She's
classist. She's a tattletale. And she's got all the power. So it's like there's no one to check her.
Who's gonna check me, boo?
I was about to say, to quote The Real Housewives, who gonna check me, boo?
Yeah.
And no one until the end.
Umbridge is awful. Absolutely terrible. But I think that that is why everyone else kind of has to band together.
Yeah.
And like how they learn to thrive in adversity.
Yes.
Because like they haven't really started the war quite yet, at mm-hmm. least overtly.
Yeah.
But you have this like this countercultural movement within mm-hmm. it of like, how do we rebel against Umbridge? We have somebody who's in power politically and whatnot, and how do we kind of get these workarounds?
Yeah.
Which ends up helping them in the long run.
That is very true. I think, yeah, unifying groups is definitely a theme of this book, and you see that on every level. You see it with the Order of the Phoenix and with adults. You see it with Dumbledore's army and the students, and there's more of unification between the three houses, between Ravenclaw, mm-hmm. Hufflepuff, and Gryffindor. I feel like there's students from Ravenclaw and Hufflepuff that get more airtime
yeah.
in this book. And up until this point, most of the characters that we ever hear about are Gryffindor and then Slytherin for the bad guy.
It's kind of like the good versus evil, and then you kind of see that it's not just only good and evil.
Yeah.
There's a lot more gray area.
Yes, there's a lot of nuance to it. And it's more than just like, oh, and the Hufflepuffs are there and the Ravenclaws are there. It's like we get a lot of Cho Chang, we get Luna Lovegood,
mm-hmm.
we get now I'm blanking on everyone's name, but Justin Finch Flinch Fletchley, whatever his name is.
The one who was petrified.
Yes. You get more of that. And you also get a sense of unity within the grades. And so mm-hmm. it's like you look at Dumbledore's army and you've got Fred and George who are in their last year of school. And then you've also got like Colin Creevy and his younger brother.
Yeah. Isn't Dennis Creevy like a first year?
I think
maybe a second year.
I think
year.
He's second year at this point, but still
he's like, little.
So, yeah. So we've got like younger students and older students that are all kind of coming together. With the same goals of like, we freaking hate Umbridge.
Mm-hmm.
And we believe, Harry, that Voldemort is back. And we also believe that, like, you feel bad for all of those students, especially Harry. But, like, they know that they're in this world where Voldemort is coming back. And they know that, like, that's a problem. We would mm-hmm. like to do something about it. But we're stuck at school. There's nothing we can do. And now we've got Dolores Umbridge, who's... her class for Defense Against the Dark Arts is literally just sit
it's
here
just
and
theory.
Read a textbook.
Yeah, so you feel like not only am I not doing something in action to take down Voldemort,
yeah,
I am actively being held back from being able to protect myself.
Yeah.
And I mean, you do see that. I think that Susan Bones, her aunt was on the council that like tries Harry and yeah. stuff like that. And I'm pretty sure she had members of her family that were at the very least tortured by mm-hmm. Voldemort and the Death Eaters. And you see that a lot of other students have been impacted. And that brings me to our absolute favorite, Neville.
This book is about Neville. In my opinion, gosh. Like this book is about Neville.
It's the story that you don't get right in your face to yeah. begin with. But his story is so central to Harry's story.
Yeah.
Like without Neville, you don't get Harry.
Yep.
You know? And so, I mean,
you see that they have a lot in common. Obviously, with the prophecy, we find out at the end that like it could have been Harry or Neville that was like destined to either take down Voldemort or be killed by Voldemort. So they have that common thread. They're born in the same month. They're in the same house. They've been living in the same dormitory with each other for 5 years now. But we also see that, you know, even though Harry's like, he's more popular, more outgoing,
charismatic.
Doesn't struggle as much in his classes. He's really athletic and like, you don't really see that from Neville. Like they've just always seemed so different.
Things don't come easily for him.
Yes. But then in this one, you see more of like, oh, so Neville has had a rough home life because of his parents living in St. Mungo's and then being raised by your grandma, who at least his grandma loves him, but it takes every opportunity to just tell him how he's not going to live up to his parents' reputation, which is a pretty messed up thing to do to this kid.
Yeah.
So he's kind of being like emotionally tortured at yeah. home. And Harry has experienced that as well. And then they also, like, they're like only children, even mm-hmm. though Harry's been raised with Dudley. That doesn't totally count. So it's like they feel kind of isolated, alone, mm-hmm. that they're in these experiences where they have a lot of like pain and sadness, and they also have a lot of isolation and feeling like no one really understands what I'm going through. I don't really want to mm-hmm. talk about it. So they both have that. But then we also see they both share a lot of the same positive traits, and you can see how they both were sorted into Gryffindor.
Yeah. Oh,
Neville
definitely.
Is very brave.
Yeah, he is brave in a way that Harry isn't necessarily brave, because Harry just kind of leaps and then he gets mm-hmm. into it and it's like, I'm here, so I got to do stuff.
Yep.
Neville is, I think, very aware of his mortality, of his like ability to fail at things. Mm-hmm. Like he's never had people that are just like, yeah, Neville, you got this, you can do this. He is like, I know that I probably can't, but yep. I'm still gonna try. And I think that is something that's like not necessarily praised enough. It's kind of like, I don't know, like gifted children when you mm-hmm. like go to school and like everything just kind of comes easily. And there's that person that like also gets the same-ish grades, but they tried really, really hard to yeah. get that. And at some point that, you know, starts to not only level out, but it starts to, you know, benefit you more in the long term.
Oh, definitely.
You've learned that I have to work harder and I have to put in this time and effort in order to get to this level. But I've put in the work and have those like habits mm-hmm. of already doing that. So I love Neville. And I mean, he lost his parents essentially around the same time as Harry, you know?
Yeah.
His parents are tortured to death weeks or months after Harry's parents are killed. So he's never experienced his parents either. And mm-hmm. I think that you see that parallel of him grasping onto those little moments. Like mm-hmm. his mom gives him a gum wrapper and his yeah. grandma says like, throw it away. And you already have enough to like wallpaper your room.
Mm-hmm.
But like Neville cherishes that. And you kind of see that when Harry was being attacked by the Dementors and he's like hearing his parents' voices yeah. for the first time. And it's like, I hate this, but I also, like, I need this. I need this interaction, this moment that I have with my parents who have gotten to experience that with them.
Craving that, like, attention and time with them. And it really makes you wonder, I mean, a strong case could be made that, like, Neville has it worse. Because having your parents be murdered and never meeting them, that is awful. But then to have your parents in front of you, and, you know, Neville's parents are living in St. Mungo's and they had been tortured by Bellatrix Lestrange and her husband to the point of insanity. And so what a cruel trick to have your parents stand in front of you and never know who you are. So you've spent hours of your life, days, months, years of your life with your parents, but you never even get one genuine conversation. To have something so close and so far away, I feel like that's almost worse.
I don't think that there's a good situation between the two of them. Just one is really terrible right away, and one is, like, really prolonged.
Yeah.
So I think it would be really difficult to have heard all these stories about how your dad is, like, this legend of an Auror, and they're so brave, and they're all these things, and now you just watch your mom get gum wrappers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's really, really hard.
Yeah.
So obviously we love Neville.
Yes, I love that we get more of him in this book. I really think that we saw a lot of their similarities in the end scene where they are breaking into the Department of Mysteries. And Harry is the one who has, like, he has skills. And we all later find out in this book, like, Voldemort, you know, marked him as his equal. That's the scar. And transferred some of his powers to Harry. Mm-hmm. Which makes a lot of sense, because you're like,
this kid is
smart and he's brave and he's, you know, he's agile and strong and athletic, but, like, he's nothing special. How does he always get out of these scenarios? And then you find out it's like, well, yeah, he kind of had this natural ability passed on to him. Then we see Neville, who none of that was passed on to him.
No.
Neville can trip over nothing. Neville can forget what the spell is and panic under pressure and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But we see that both of them, they're the two that end up at the very end, like, in the room with, like, all of the Death Eaters.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it's because the two of them, they do share that same drive of, like, I don't think either of them necessarily had a plan. I think Harry definitely had more of a plan than Neville, but, like, Neville was all gas, no brakes in that whole scene. He was like, oh no, I'm going for it. I'm going all the way to the end. He's like, at one point, he can't even speak right.
Because his nose has been broken.
So whenever he tries to say the spells, like, he can't actually cast the spells because they're not coming out right.
Yeah.
But he is still, like, chasing Harry, running after, and, like, he is there to risk it all. But you see, it's like, out of everyone there, everyone has a personal connection and a reason to want to keep Voldemort from coming to power, for obvious reasons. But Neville and Harry are the two who've lost their parents to this.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think Neville would have fought Bellatrix with his bare hands.
I mean,
given the chance.
I think at one point he does just, like, jump on the back of one of the Death Eaters, you know? Like, he is...
Yeah.
I can't really do anything. I'm gonna just stab you with my wand.
Yeah. He stabs through the Death Eater.
In the eye, though. I hold the mask.
Stabs him in the eye, and I'm like...
That's a power move.
That hurts.
Yeah, it did.
That'll do something. Yeah, and
that might hurt more than just being, like, stunned, honestly. Like,
definitely.
Your eyeball is so sensitive. But, I mean, like, I love that. And
I mean, it just shows he's so brave. He really is a Gryffindor. And I think he has been probably teased a lot at his time at Hogwarts that, like, yeah, he's the guy who can't remember anything. He's the guy who just kind of comes across like a bumbling, like, klutzy person, and he still is that too, but, like, he's got the heart of the Gryffindor lion.
Yeah. And when you see who goes to the Department of Mysteries with Harry. Harry is going to go, whether Hermione and Ron want him to or not.
Yeah.
Like, that is not even in question. Harry is going there.
Yeah.
Hermione's going to play devil's advocate and, you know, look through everything and, you know, bring up valid points, which she ends up being
and
right.
Thank God. Yeah, she was right. And had he listened to her, the whole situation would have been avoided.
Yes. And then Ron is a total scaredy cat, but then also like, okay, if you need me, mate, I'm going to be there.
Very loyal, and
I'll be your second, but like, I'm never gonna be the one that's like really pushing to go do these things.
No,
but like, I'll be there. But would you need that?
Yeah, once he's there, he's all in. He's never like hiding. I mean, even when it's what, the second book, when they go and see Aragog and all the spiders, and that's his worst fear, it's like, yeah, he's terrified the whole time, but like, he's there, he still went.
Yeah. And then you get Neville, who lost his parents, mm-hmm. and, you know, like, has every reason to fight against Voldemort. And you get Luna, who also has lost her mother and has seen, you know, sees Thestrals just like Harry and Neville do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that those two, really beyond even Voldemort, they understand that Sirius is Harry's only, like, real, like,
yeah,
I mean, legitimate parent figure. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of other parental figures in Harry's life, for yeah. sure. But this is someone that Harry could, like, potentially live with. This yeah. is someone who can legally sign off on things for him, get him to Hogsmeade, yep. whatnot. And these are two people who understand the depth of loss of those that you love.
Yep.
So, like, the other two are there to, you know, support Harry no matter what, but Luna and Neville are like, let's fight for people.
Also,
it's worth it.
Sorry, just to interrupt for just 1 second. With Luna, it's like kind of similar to Neville, how he's kind of been portrayed as like someone who's maybe not very brave or very competent, and she is portrayed as just being such a space case and just super weird,
because
she is. And then you're like, how did she get into Ravenclaw? Like, that's supposed to be the really smart house. She's the one who figures out how to get them from Hogwarts to the Ministry of Magic.
We'll take Thestrals. Of course.
Yeah, and she's just like, yeah, duh, here's your obvious solution right in front of you.
But so, she's never going to say it like that. She just is always like, well, oh, we'll fly there.
We'll fly, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a spot on impression.
Thank
I'm going to listen to it later, and it's going to sound nothing,
nothing
like her.
Nothing
but,
like her.
I mean, but it's just so crazy
yeah.
that, I mean,
all of their strengths, though, like, That's what Dumbledore's been saying this whole time. Like, stay together, stay unified, stay a team, because then you get everyone's strengths. And we see that even just from a group of kids, everyone's strengths played a role.
Yeah, they really did. And I guess we kind of just like jump straight to the end, because we're just like obsessed with Neville, because he's just like the absolute yeah. best.
Also, but Ginny, like, was in the group.
Oh, sorry.
I'm yeah. so sorry. I can't leave
How
her
did
out.
I forget about Ginny?
Queen Ginny.
We love Ginny. We stan Ginny.
One of my biggest takeaways from the whole book was just like how amazing Ginny is.
Ginny is so smart and so brave and so just like cunning and like just like funny.
Oh, the only reason that she wasn't the most powerful witch or wizard in their little group that went to rescue Sirius was just because she was a year younger.
Yeah.
That's the only thing they have on her is time.
Well, and Ginny really proves herself of like, you know, they're so, you know, Sirius is being tortured and Harry's like, oh my gosh, we need to get to the ministry. And they're like, how do we check and see if Sirius is, you know, at home? Well, we've got to use the flu network, and the only one is going to be in Umbridge's office. And they're like, how do we cause this diversion, or like get her mm-hmm. away from this? And Ginny's like, oh no, I already got this. Like, Fred and George left a couple extra things that they were going to do to like terrorize Umbridge, and yeah, I'm going to do that. And they're like,
yeah.
Oh, wait, what? She's like, Don't worry about it. I got this.
Yeah.
I'm Fred and George's younger sister.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason why I'm not like a part of them is because I'm smart enough to just kind of like sit back in the shadows and like mm-hmm. ride the wave and
mm-hmm.
and be like, I'm not going to get in trouble for this because you are.
Exactly. No, she is strategic. She's smart. She's funny. Turns out she's super athletic. She becomes the Seeker when Harry gets kicked off of the Quidditch team because Umbridge is a turd.
A raging lunatic, yeah. Maniacal, sociopath.
Yeah.
All of the words.
Evil.
And a lot of words that I cannot say on air.
Without getting the explicit rating. But yeah, she's all those
things. She's the worst. Yeah. She's just the worst.
The worst. And Ginny Weasley, the best.
The best. But yeah, Ginny is a boss. So, like, we skip straight to the end, but the beginning starts off real strong, mm-hmm. too. So, like, we figured out, like, Cedric dies, I Googled it. Cedric dies on June 24th. The school year ends, like, the last week of June. So, you know, at most, there are, like, 6 more days
yeah.
left in the school year. And then we come and meet Harry, and it's been 4 weeks into summer break.
Yep.
So, at most, it's been, like, 5 weeks since Cedric has died, the return of Voldemort, and Dumbledore has given, like, marching orders to the Order of the Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you get, like, so frustrated throughout the book when you didn't know how it's going to end, mm-hmm. of, like, how is not more happening? Like, you're from the point of view of Harry of, like,
yes.
This is so infuriating. I don't know anything. Why is no one telling me anything? And I feel so bad for him.
That's why I hated the book when I first, maybe not hated, but that's why I didn't enjoy this book the first time I read through it, was because I didn't know what was going to happen. Yeah, I just felt, like, so frustrated. Like, we don't know anything. Nothing's happening. And on this reread, I'm like, holy crap. 4 weeks.
5 weeks.
5 weeks. And they've already, you know, Harry has 24/7 surveillance, like, people are watching out for him. The Order of the Phoenix has a headquarters at Grimmauld Place, which is Sirius's childhood home. They've already recruited some new members, and it's, like, the core people that you would expect, like the Weasleys and Snape and Dumbledore and...
But then some others, you've got Mundungus, Kingsley, Fletcher.
Mundungus, Fletcher.
Tonks, you've got...
Yeah.
You know, like...
So they've already, like, recruited, and then, like, they seem to be pretty well, like, organized.
Yeah.
And they have a plan. And yeah, Lupin is there too. So they've done so much. And then they keep saying things like, oh, like, so-and-so's on duty tonight or whatever. Like, it's their turn. And then you find out, yeah, they already knew that Voldemort would immediately want to go and get his hands on this prophecy. So they've already had people, like, set up to guard it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're doing so much. They basically just want the kids, like, hey, guys, if you guys can just go entertain yourselves for a little while, like, mom and dad are busy
mm-hmm.
trying to defeat Lord Voldemort. And then, you know, that ends up kind of biting them in the butt later. And Dumbledore even admits that at the end, that, you know, he made some mistakes that were, like, an old man's mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And basically realizing, like, oh, right, they're not just going to sit there and wait. They're going to want to take action.
Well, and maybe that's also, like, the foolishness of, like, you're saying to be unified, you're saying to bridge these gaps, you're saying all these things about how that's how we're powerful, and then you're taking these kids who not only want to be a part of it, they're going to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And no matter what way you flip it, they are very central to this whole plan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's partially why they don't want them involved, because it's like, then it's really real.
Yeah.
And we want to protect you, and we want you to get guys to be kids, and I don't want you to have to go through this. So, like, maybe for just a couple more moments, a couple more, you know, days, years, weeks, whatever.
Yeah.
I want you to be able to be a kid. But the reality is that they're gonna be a part of this. So by keeping them in the dark and leaving them out of so many things, you're kind of taking away from a lot of assets that you could be having.
Yeah.
And I mean, Harry's been having these, like, dreams for a long time. And I mean, you see it starting in, I think, the second book, where, you know, he's having these dreams of what Voldemort's doing or how he's feeling, whatnot. And Harry really never feels comfortable enough with anyone, even like Ron and Hermione, to like fully share what they are, you know, because he doesn't know that it's Voldemort per se, but he always kind of sugarcoats it or like leaves things out of like when he attacks Mr. Weasley, he like doesn't want to say that like I was the snake that attacked Mr. Weasley. It was me and I wanted to.
Yeah.
And they don't even tell him what this means, you know?
Which would be so frustrating.
Yeah, and that's where you're coming from at the beginning of the book, just only in the Harry part, because you don't see necessarily the back.
No. Yeah, you start off with him like laying on his back in Aunt Petunia's garden trying to listen to the Muggle news to hear if anything has happened, and he's literally just laying there for hours. So from his perspective, it's like nothing's happening.
All I'm doing is waiting. And again, this kid 5 weeks ago was cut open, watched his arch nemesis come back to life, see the followers, and watch someone die.
Yeah.
Like,
the same people who were responsible for killing his parents.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's a lot. This kid should have been...
leave him, like, out in the middle, you know? Right?
That's cool that you're technically protected, but, like, whew, some counseling would have been nice.
Could nobody have, like, come and, like, stop by for just a minute? You know, like, hey, Harry, just wanted to check in on you.
Yeah, how you doing?
Not this whole, like, just wait it out, mate. Like, just sit back. Just keep your head down.
I think, too, though, like, to give them a little bit of grace, it's like they are preparing for war.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like you are stressed out. You're under a time crunch. And, yeah, you're making the best decisions that you know how to with the amount of information that you have and the amount of resources that you have. And so I don't think any of the members of the Order of the Phoenix would say, like, yes, we're doing everything 100% exactly the way we should be. I think they're all just like, we're doing our best and really don't want this Lord Voldemort guy to come take over the world again. But, yeah.
Yeah.
We got a lot on their plates.
They do. They really do. So I will, like, as an adult rereading it, I will cut some slack on things because you can't just get it perfect every time.
But I feel like they all just, like, jumped into action mode of, like, we got to take care of the problem. And while they do, you see that everyone really does, like, care about Harry on a personal level, too. But yeah, this poor kid's emotional health is just completely, like, never supported.
Yeah. Speaking of being supported, let's take a moment to hear from our sponsors.
For this episode.
Yeah.
Want to rate movies and write movie reviews but have no idea where to start? With the Cinephile Journal, being your own film critic has never been easier. You can log and rate all the movies you watch with an easy-to-use scoring system. The notebook has a mix of guided content and blank space, so you can write on every page and let your creativity flow. There are pages to track every movie you watch, and other pages that ask you general questions about your favorite movies, actors, and directors. This movie journal is a must-buy for every movie lover you know. Just search The Cinephile Journal on Amazon, or you can go to our show notes for a link.
Hello there, my fellow basic cinephile fan. Jeremy Hirschkorn of Jet Movement Academy here. In my experience as a gym owner and trainer, I've seen the world start to change. You'll need new strategies to keep your health in top condition. That's why I'm offering Jet Online. This is a complete training and coaching package available wherever you have internet access. Go to jetmovement.com to sign up today or contact me at jeremy@jetmovement.com. Wishing you happy listening and amazing health. Keep moving.
Right, and we are back. Thank you for your support. And now we're going to go into the people that are not supportive / suck.
Cornelius Fudge.
Oh, the man is a weasel.
The fudge meister.
The fudge. He is a pile of fudge.
He's a pile of fudge.
And by fudge, I mean poop.
Poop. Yeah. Definitely. So Fudge, in previous books, all of his interactions with Harry have been very, like, jovial, but, like, kind of skeezy politician, where it's like, oh, hello, Harry, hi.
You've got some celebrities, so I exactly. would like you to be around me, and I'm gonna kind of give you these special treatments. Hey, you know what? You perform some magic. I'm... You know, not a big deal.
Yes,
we don't care about it.
The time that he, like, they thought that he blows up Aunt Marge.
I mean, he does.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wait, sorry. I thought he got blamed for Dobby doing magic in his house.
He did.
Okay.
And then he actually gets...
Yes, okay, that's what it was. Okay, so when that happens, and Harry straight up thinks he's going to be expelled because he knows that he messed up and did something wrong, and he shows up and... That is after Sirius had escaped from Azkaban. And so Fudge is just like so excited that Harry's alive and safe that he's just like, oh, we don't care about you doing underage magic.
It's you're just a fun. Kid. You can't always control what you're doing.
So every interaction he's ever had with Fudge has kind of been like that. Like Harry gets away with stuff. Fudge always comes up and like says hi. But he also like doesn't have real conversations. He doesn't actually listen to what Harry is saying.
They're not tight.
No, he doesn't ask him questions or know him on a personal level at all. But then in this book, it's like, ooh, so Harry said something that he doesn't like, which was that Lord Voldemort is back, which is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Fudge decided he didn't like that. Goes on this huge smear campaign
of Dumbledore, of Harry.
He's discrediting
15 years old.
And he's telling the media to just, like, slander his name, discredit him, call him crazy.
He's been passing out in classes, and he's always been breaking these rules, and he's always been doing this. And you're like,
what?
Okay, you are a grown adult who is picking on a teenager.
Yes. For no other reason than making your own life easier. So it's pretty messed up. I think up to this point, it's like, we haven't really gotten to know Fudge all that well, but we see this side of him, and it's like, while I don't think that Fudge is a straight-up bad guy, we see that he's definitely not a good guy.
No, and you see that Percy Weasley has, like, joined arm-in-arm with
he
Fudge.
He has chosen his side. Percy is a total butt munch in this book, too.
Yeah,
he cuts off his parents, Molly and Arthur Weasley. Tells them that he doesn't want to be a part of their family anymore. They need to stay away from Harry Potter. They need to stay away from Dumbledore.
Yeah, you need to get on the right side of things and be with the ministry and be supportive and, you know.
No, Percy shows his true colors in this book, too. And it's like, I've been supportive of Percy up until this point. Like, yeah, he's been kind of annoying and a little bit of a know-it-all and whatever. But, like, he's an ambitious guy. He wants to break out of his life of poverty. He wants to be known for his own, like, skills and accomplishments.
And
not just for, like, being a part of the tribe of the Weasleys.
Mm-hmm.
So, which I totally understand. That's fine. But I don't think you need to break your parents' hearts in order to do that. He could have been on the other side and not necessarily agreed with Harry or believed him without, like, actively being so mean.
And I think that that's just what a good representation of, like, how ambition can go wrong.
Yeah.
And, like, Harry was, like, this in-between of, like, Slytherin or Gryffindor.
Yeah.
And I think that you see that overlap there where, like, Percy is still a Gryffindor. He's still, you know,
mm-hmm.
has done some brave things, but, like, he's also got some of that Slytherin in him.
He does.
He's willing to make these compromises or look past these things. Look past the fact that you've known Harry for years and he's always been trustworthy up until this point, and you've given him extra points on during the Triwizard tournament when you're sitting in for Barty Crouch, and you're still, like, willing to compromise on things that you know in order to further your career.
Yes, and I think, I mean, Harry has always kind of had this up and down thing because he's so famous, and so it's like people always feel like they know him, and so they'll be like, we love Harry, for having no reason
mm-hmm.
to back that up, and then be like, oh, we hate Harry, again having no reason to believe that. I feel like Percy's betrayal, even though Harry and Percy have never been friends, he's never, like, particularly enjoyed Percy, you can tell that Percy's betrayal really, really stings more than most people's, because it's like he's like, yeah, I've stayed at your house. I have lived in your home. I have gone to the Quidditch World Cup with you. It's like, we've gone on vacation. I've stayed at your house. I'm best friends with your younger brother.
We've gone to school for many years. You were there for my first year. You were prefect. Yes. And, you know, like.
And then to find out, like, you're telling people that I'm dangerous and unhinged.
Yeah.
And that's messed up.
And beyond that, Harry is so conscious of the way that others, I guess, are impacted by their relationship with him. Mm-hmm. He's always so worried about people getting injured, and like his trauma response is just like, let me just separate myself from everyone and not ask for help and everything. And people have come out and been like, that's not really an option. We love you and we're gonna be there for you. And now he's seeing that the Weasley family, who he loves and has become a part of, has kind of gotten torn apart a little bit because of him. So that's got a sting too. So you're angry that you're not believing me because I went through this and it's real. But then also it's like, well, shoot, like, this is my best friend's family. And even though Percy was kind of a git, we didn't like him, but but still, it's, that's your family. And Harry is one that would never want to, like, isolate family for the most part.
Yeah.
I mean, except for the Dursleys, and they just kind of, like, suck, and
they just always suck. And
they're just blood. They're not family. They're just blood.
Yep. Yep. No, and it, yeah, we see he literally is a part of the Weasley family because with Molly Weasley, when she confronts the Boggart in Grimmauld Place, and Harry goes up and he sees, like, you know, the Boggart takes the form of your deepest fear, and she has to see all of her children dead on the floor because that's her greatest fear. Then she sees Arthur dead on the floor, and she sees Harry dead on the floor. And so we see, like, that's not something that you can fake. That's, like, in your heart, she considers him to be one of the kids. And she sends him Easter gifts and Christmas gifts. And she really has, like, opened up her home and her heart to Harry. And so Harry, even though he's, like, adopted into the family, right? So finding out all of this betrayal by Percy, it stings because you're like, oh, my God, like, you don't believe me at all. But then also it's like, you hurt Mrs. Weasley, and, like, I like her. She's the closest thing to a mom I've ever had, and, like, you're hurting Mr. Weasley, and, like, that's a man I respect and look up to and who looks out for me. So I think he's feeling that hurt on, like, so many forefronts.
And I mean, how do you not? And I think that it just shows Molly Weasley's capability to love, and I mean, it is her kid, so even if he, like, completely screws her over, she's still going to be like, that's my kid, I raised you, everything. Yeah. But she sees Percy on the ground dead as well. It's one of those things where it's like, we just wrote him off. It's like, no, this haunts me all the time, and I would gladly lay down my life for you in this particular moment.
Yeah.
Even when you're being, you know, completely distanced yourself from the family, like, I would still go and give my life for you.
Yes, this is not Mrs. Black. This is not the, I'm going to burn Sirius Black off of my family tree on the tapestry because I don't agree with your life choices. Mrs. Weasley has a very different outlook, and she's just the best.
She's so great. I love her so, so much.
Speaking of more people that we don't love, we talked about her a little bit already, but Dolores Umbridge is just a delightful antagonist. She gets under your skin. She makes me have physical responses. Like, I feel my shoulders tensing up and my stomach tightening when I'm reading some of these scenes about the things that she would do. And that is... that's kind of brilliant. Even though, like, you hate her, it's like, to be able to evoke that much emotion from a reader, just, like, reading about this person that you hate, oh my God, she is delightfully terrible.
And I think that the reason why she's, like, so terrible and gets under your skin and everything is that it's, like, a realistic character.
Yes.
Like, Voldemort, you know, like, there are some really bad people in the world, but, like, at the end of the day, they're not, like, creating horcruxes and, you know, just out here becoming, you know, like noseless and, you know, less human, whatnot.
I don't know anyone that looks like a snake that's trying to kill me.
Yeah. But you do see these people that are in power that really like come across very sweet. She wears her nice little suits and she has her bow and she has that high voice. And like, so she has all these things that are like, quote unquote, like normal or good or, you know, and then she's just awful. She's just absolutely a psychopath.
She wants to use the Cruciatus curse on students. She is the one who set the Dementors loose on Harry. She is, yeah, she is literally just evil incarnate.
Yeah, and she like makes everyone feel less than and, you know, like is judging everyone. She
Yes, she stresses Hagrid out to the point that he can barely teach his lessons. She's got Trelawney crying. And then all of the other belittling teachers.
Belittling Flitwick and, the teachers, Ferenz when he takes over. She's like, oh, you're half centaur, you know, or not half centaur. You are a centaur. And
she calls him like a half-breed or something. Or
of like near human intelligence.
Yes.
And you're like, oh, screw off, lady.
No, you're like, centaurs are just different than humans. And
actually that's way great. Smarter.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Like, they're only not classified as like human intelligence because they literally took themselves out of the, sorry, is this in this book or is this in Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them? Because I was reading that too.
It might be that because I don't feel like I'm familiar with what you're talking about.
Okay, so basically like they did like the classifications of like magical creatures and whatnot if you're like, okay, human or human intelligence, if, and it was considered like if you speak the language and like if you speak English or whatnot and like a couple different things. And centaurs, they were like, oh, you can be part of this like human intelligence, and they're like, no, we're good, we're gonna be classified as a creature. Yep. Because I don't want to be associated with you.
Yeah, no thanks.
And like,
write your little book, that's cute.
Yeah.
We'll be in the forest doing our own thing.
Yeah, okay. It's like, as like the magical laws were being made, they're like, no.
No.
Like, that's cool, but no. I don't need to be a part of the wizarding world. Yeah. I'm better than that. Yeah.
Okay.
So like, so for her to call them of near human intelligence, it's like,
yeah.
Literally no one has said that centaurs are not incredibly intelligent.
Yeah.
Like, get out of here.
She's so rude. And she has some really great interactions with
McGonagall.
Because McGonagall does not put up with her crap. And so, like, the first instance that we see of that is when Umbridge has been doing, like, performance reviews for all of the teachers.
Sitting in the classes.
So she shows up to Transfiguration class. And McGonagall just starts teaching like usual. And then Umbridge does her little like to get attention. And McGonagall just keeps...
Did you get my letter?
She keeps ignoring her. Yeah. And then she's like, oh, did you get my letter that I would be sitting in your class? And McGonagall's response is just, yes, obviously. Or else I would ask you what you're doing in my classroom. And that just kind of sets the tone. Like, they put up with her, but in the most subversive ways. There's kind of like two classes of the teachers. There's the Trelawneys and the Hagrids, who are like very flustered and bothered by her. And then there are like Flitwick and Snape and McGonagall, and they kind of like subvert her in every way possible. Like, once the Weasleys set off all those fireworks and stuff, but she, Umbridge, had passed one of her little decrees, educational decrees, that, you know, the teachers are not allowed to talk about things that aren't related to their subjects in the class. And so as a way to be like, F you, they're like, oh, well, we can't talk about anything that's not related to our subject. So they would call her in to like take care of every single firework explosion that's going off in their classroom. And then as she's leaving, I think it was Flitwick that was like, basically like, oh, thank you. I would have been able to take care of this quite easily on my own, but I wanted to make sure that I was following your rules and I wasn't talking about anything I wasn't supposed to talk about. And I love that. She's just like running around like a chicken with her head cut off, taking care of all this stuff. And these teachers that are like, yeah, I could just flick my wrist and fix this, were like, but I'm not going to.
Well, I love, so like in the movie, they do all the fireworks and whatnot, and it's kind of like this one big bang shaboom.
Yeah.
I, like, one of the most, like, iconic things that stands out in my mind constantly, I think about this probably on at least a weekly basis. The Weasleys create, like, a swamp, like, somehow.
A portable swamp.
And so, like, they set it up in one of the corridors, and Filch has to straight up boat these kids in, like, a gondola type thing across this swamp to get to their other classes. And that's just his full-time job. He's just out there just boating kids around. And
Umbridge can't figure it out. So no. This thing is out for like weeks.
Yeah, it sounds like it's out for like a lot of the term.
A long time because it's not until after she leaves
that Flitwick comes and just like immediately takes care of almost all of it, but leaves a little square, a little patch and just says, it's really good magic.
Yeah.
Like, I just kind of like that, you know, we're going to remember Fred and George. Like, this is pretty good.
I think he might have even roped it off. It was like a little section in the corner and he left it. And they were talking about, they're like, why did he do that? And I guess, Flitwick had said that it was really impressive magic.
Yeah.
And then I think it was Ron that said, like, that he thinks Flitwick wanted to leave an homage to Fred and George, because Fred and George have that moment where they're like, you know, I think
our time at Hogwarts is done
and our futures lie outside of the academic environment or whatever. And basically they've got their business plan set up to open Weasley Wizarding Wheezes, and they realize like Umbridge is awful and they have the unique position of like, we want to leave and we're actually completely all set to leave. So we can afford to be bold and like really take a stand against her because she doesn't actually have anything she can hold over us.
Yeah. I'm too young for you to just like send me to Azkaban or like whatever. Expel me. Great.
Sure.
I have somewhere else to be.
I don't want to be here.
I was kind of just going to school to like pacify my parents. Like they wanted us to go to this last year of school, but here's the thing. They hate you too, so they're not going to be mad about this.
No one's going to care. But I just love that, like, there are professors like Flitwick who, you know, they do have to put up with more of Umbridge because, first of all, it's their job. And second of all, they care deeply about the students. And they understand that the Ministry of Magic is infiltrating Hogwarts and that there are people within the Ministry of Magic who are not good people. And they're like, we need to stay here for the safety of our students. But in order to stay here, I need to make sure I'm not getting fired. And so, leaving that little corner of the swamp where it's like, you know what? Thank you. My hat's off to you for doing what I couldn't do.
Yeah.
But what I really wanted to.
Yeah.
And we're just going to leave a little swamp.
I'm just going to let it happen.
Yeah.
I'm going to do nothing to stop it. But I'm also like, I can't technically encourage it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I love Flitwick. He's great.
Flitwick. He's amazing.
A teacher that sucks, though.
Snape. Okay.
I don't fully remember, like, every single instance and thing that happens in the next two books. So he could still come back for me. But at this point, Snape is pretty unredeemable as a character for me.
Yes.
He is a straight up just a-hole to Harry constantly. Like, also, all of the time.
Also, to Neville.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, he has no reason. So it's like, you know, he's got that, what am I trying to say? He's got it out for Harry because he hated Harry's dad. And then we see that memory in the Pensieve that, like, James Potter was an absolute bully and terrorized Snape. So he has a very legitimate reason to be upset with James Potter. I fully understand that. Then the fact that Harry looks so much like James, that would be very triggering. Now, the way that he handles his traumatic rage is very immature and not okay.
So inappropriate. It's just absolutely insane. And I get that he's like kind of playing both sides of this. So he can't just go around and be like, Harry, yeah, I'm part of the Order. Yeah, welcome to Hogwarts, whatnot. But outside of this podcast, Dion and I were discussing, like, you can be indifferent to someone, and that is just as effective.
He didn't have to like Harry, but he needed to not actively terrorize him. And then with Neville, it's like, he has no reason like that to hate Neville, and he is so mean to him and puts so much pressure on him, ridicules him, makes fun of him in front of the class. And then we see when they're taking their OWLs, Harry was like, wow, it's actually a lot easier to make a potion when I'm not stressed out by my teacher bullying me.
Yeah.
And then he said he looked over and he saw that, like, Neville had never looked so relieved and so confident while making a potion. And, like, Neville looked like he was doing okay too. So I'm like, okay, Snape, you can come up with whatever BS excuse you have for the way that you treat Harry, but it's also the way you treat everyone else. And he is so mean to Hermione. He bullies so many
of
his
students.
To the Weasleys,
it's like straight up just everyone that's like not a Slytherin. He is just so mean to. It's just so actively like, it's just an active meanness.
It's uncalled for too, because then later we do see that he ends up being, you know, someone who is both in the Order of the Phoenix and a Death Eater, and he has to play both sides, and he has to make it look like he's still one of Lord Voldemort's loyal followers, which I understand. But for the first four books, Voldemort is not back, so he doesn't need to be playing that character. And also, he can still favor Malfoy and without, again, actively bullying and harassing his other students.
Yeah.
So for me, that is completely inexcusable. And I don't think there's a redemption arc for that.
No, I don't think so either. Because, like, yeah, you kept this kid alive through your actions. Great. But you have tormented him for so many years. And as he's teaching occlumency, how are you ever supposed to get better at this? You just have someone that wants to essentially torture you, but is now given an opportunity to dive into your memories, which is, like, already such a, like, I mean, it's so personal. So it's already, like, very invasive. And so the fact that Snape is, like, so angry that Harry sees some of his memories, it's like, that's not fair. You're diving into Harry's memories. You're diving into seeing what Cho's doing, you know, like, how he feels about Cho. Like, that's very invasive, and you don't have to go that hard, that fast to teach someone that. In fact, I'm sure that most people would agree that when you're getting taught something, it's better to work up to these things.
Yes.
At least get some kind of ground rules. Instead, Snape just, like, sits him there and then just is like, legumens, and, like,
no,
how am I supposed to protect myself? Nobody has ever told me what the heck to do.
That's the other thing. This Snape has been teaching for over 10 years or something, right? So he's not a brand new teacher. He might hate Harry, but he has chosen to be an educator, and you should take pride in your job and doing it well. And so he should know that, like, yeah, the way that he's teaching Harry isn't working. And so, I mean, I used to be a teacher, and it's like, okay, if one kid fails your test, it's like, well, yeah, they probably didn't study. But sometimes you give a test and it's like, oh, okay, class average was a D. And I'm like, that wasn't their fault. That was my fault. Clearly, I didn't format this test in a way that accurately tested them, or I didn't give them enough time to study, or I didn't properly cover the materials in class. And so I feel like with him, it's like, yeah, he just bullies Neville and, like, makes fun of him for never being able to make a potion correctly. And it's like, dude, if this kid's been sitting in your class every day for 4 years and he's still struggling to make basic potions, that's not a Neville problem. That's a Snape problem.
Yeah.
If you're having all these occlumency lessons and you're always just immediately able to get into Harry's mind, it's like, okay, well then let's not keep doing the same thing over and over again. Let's teach new skills. Let's try a new method. Let's give this kid some confidence. Or maybe, you know, because you're supposed to just completely empty your mind, right? And Harry is like so filled with rage every time he's around Snape mm-hmm. that he can't clear his mind. And that's that's a Snape problem, not a Harry problem.
And when you're angry, like, your mind is not clear. Like,
no.
In any way, shape, or form. And you, like, can't get out of that. So, yeah. Like,
and if all you're telling yourself to do is to calm down.
calm down.
We all know that doesn't work.
Yeah, no. So, Snape is gonna have to really have something better than this, like, always I've loved her.
TBD, but he still sucks. And I don't think that being psychotically in love with someone's mom 20 years later, it's just creepy. And I don't know. We'll see.
Tacky and I hate you. Someone that did get redeemed for me is Rita Skeeter.
Which
I completely forgot about. Yeah, it's been just smear campaign of Harry and Dumbledore, everything, all these, like, lies being told. In the
Daily Prophet, yeah.
Yeah, and so Rita has not been writing for the Daily Prophet because she's been being blackmailed by Hermione.
Yeah.
And they sit down and they do an interview of, like, the whole shebang, everything that happened with Harry in the Triwizard mm-hmm. Tournament, and Rita publishes it in the Quibbler. And so, like, Rita is kind of a sketchy person, yes. But also, like, at the end of the day, she is a journalist.
She wants to get the scoop.
She wants the scoop, and she wants to get back in the game. She's been, like, out here just sitting back watching all these other people write these weird things, like, terrible things. And she wishes she could write the terrible things.
Yeah, she does.
And she's just kind of held accountable by these kids to not write terrible things, but to write the truth. And that there is a lot of value in the truth.
Yeah. I loved that part. Yeah. He does, like, the tell-all interview. He tells his whole story, and that becomes, like, a true turning point in the book because mm-hmm. it does sway public opinion. And I love, like, he gets all these owls the day after it's printed or whatever. And everyone comes over and starts, like, helping open them. And it's, like, basically everyone's like, oh, this person supports you. And the next one, they're like, oh, this person, like, still doesn't believe you. One of my favorites, it was one of the Weasleys that read it, was like, this person believes you because, like, your story sounds credible. But then also they don't want to believe you because they don't want Lord Voldemort to be back. And then they're like, well, that was a waste.
Yeah,
basically, this person, like, never actually took a stand to say, like, I believe you or I don't believe you. They're like, here's all the reasons why I think I should believe you. Here's all the reasons why I don't think I should believe you. And I don't know where I stand. And they were just like, why did you tell us that?
Yeah. And also in the Quibbler, okay. I was really loving that the Quibbler was posting these things about, like, how Sirius could not be, you know, a Death Eater, or, like, he didn't break out of Azkaban because he's actually the lead singer of this, you know, of this band that I've been in love with. And he was with me the night that, you know, like, all this stuff happened, which, I mean, is not true at all. But, no. Like, also,
you love, like, to see it.
You love to see it. You love to see that. And Sirius really got a kick out of that, too.
Yes.
Because he's been cooped up in Grimmauld Place the whole time with Creature, his house elf, who is, like, very old, very, like, grumpy, crotchety old elf.
Creature. Master wouldn't like all mm-hmm. of these
half-bloods
in our house.
Yeah, so.
Should I keep doing impressions? Because I really feel, I think, like,
you're nailing it. I'm here for it. But, like, Sirius is a total jerk to Creature all the time.
Yeah.
Creature is not a joy to be around. Like, I'll give you that. But, like, Sirius is so mean to him. And then, like, that's part of his downfall, because Creature plays, and house elves in general, plays such a central role in this series.
Yes.
It's the people that are, I guess they're not people, quote unquote. It's these servants who are so looked down upon that they're just, like, not even relevant to their daily lives. They're just, they clean up stuff.
But they know everything. They know all the
everything.
Tea about everyone. Yes.
Yeah. And, like, just because they can't, like, say something about it doesn't mean that they can't allude to things.
That's the thing. It's, like, they're not allowed to disobey their family. But if they really want to, they're intelligent and they do have their own magic. And so it's like...
That it's like more powerful than wizards?
To take this level of arrogance of like, well, you know, they're my house elf and they're destined to do whatever I want them to do. It's like, yeah, but if you create an environment where they don't want to be loyal to you, they can find ways to still follow all the rules.
Yeah.
And be disloyal. Like, and that's exactly what Creature did. Yeah. I completely forgot about that plot point. Sirius basically gets mad at him and says something like, get out. And he takes that as a...
All right, you told me to get green light. Out of this place.
He's like, get out, and that means I can go wherever I want.
I'm so going to go to my closest black family relative that I respect, which is
Narcissa Malfoy. So runs straight to the Malfoys and then is in cahoots with them. And they
we know that Lucius is a Death Eater. You know, we know that they're involved.
And, you know, they tell Voldemort, like, okay, we've got, like, an inside person now.
That... He can't tell us about the Order of the Phoenix. He can't tell us about the location. But what he can tell is that Harry loves Sirius so much, and Sirius loves Harry so much, and they will both do anything to help the other, you know?
Yep, and that ends up being basically, like, the essential connection that they needed to be able to make their plan happen to lure Harry into
they needed Creature.
Yeah.
And yet again, I mean, we'll talk about this in the later books, but like, yet again, Creature coming in clutch and helping out Voldemort, and Voldemort just like disregarding all of his help. I don't think that Voldemort would give Creature a lick of credit for what he did.
And like, Creature's a turd, but Creature has a bit of a redemption story. Or at least, maybe not redemption, but I don't hate him.
I don't hate him either.
I see exactly why Creature has done all of the things that he has done.
Creature is a product of his environment.
Exactly.
And he is not actively teaching students year after year and being a complete jerk to them. Because the Weasley twins said that Snape was a jerk. I'm pretty sure that Bill and Charlie said that Snape was a jerk. It's just like for years and years. And these are people that are not necessarily in like fighting against Voldemort, you know, like it's just not cool. No, not cool, man. Not cool. Well,
again, Neville. Why did he choose Neville? It's like, you know that his parents were on the same side of the fight against Voldemort that you were on. You know that his parents were tortured, and you know that he's essentially an orphan, and your greatest joy in life after tormenting Harry Potter is tormenting Neville. Get a life, Snape.
Seriously, get a life that
and
is...
And seriously, Sirius dies in this one. It sucks. I was really sad. I cried multiple times in this book.
I cried a fair amount.
I cried at the scene where Neville's parents are in St. Mungo's. And it was the moment where he got the gum wrapper from his mom. Yeah. I was like bawling. And then Molly Weasley fighting the Boggart and seeing like her whole family die. And then her saying basically like, when they're trying to comfort her and saying, you know, Molly, it'll all be okay. And her being like, I know for a fact, I have a lot of kids. They're all signing up to fight against Voldemort. We might not win this fight, or we might win this fight, but I know for a fact, my whole family's not making it out alive.
And as we mentioned in the previous episode about Death Eaters, her two brothers were killed.
Exactly. She's already lost family to Voldemort. And I'm sure friends. And then, you know, Harry is her adopted son, basically. And he's lost people close to him. So, yeah, she knows what she's in for. And that was heartbreaking. And then Sirius's death. I definitely cried at that part. It's just, it sucks. Like, he was just such a good parental figure and family member for Harry. And then Harry loses him.
And Sirius has, you know, his good and his bad parts. But, like, Sirius does have a lot of redemption for me.
Yes. Sirius is a deeply human character. Again, we've all been bad in moments. And there's moments of things that you do where you're like, oh my God, I'm mortified I ever did that. I would never do it again. And I do enjoy that when Harry confronted Lupin and Sirius about that memory, and it's so serious to him that he risks a lot to go to Umbridge's office and use the Flu Network. And he's like, I need to talk to you guys about this right now. I hate Snape. That was messed up the way you treated him.
Mm-hmm.
And for them both to be like, yeah, no, that was messed up. Yeah, that was awful. We were 15. We were young. We would never do that now. Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to do these occlumency lessons. And they're both like, no.
No, you need to do it.
I know that we don't like Snape. And we'd never really have, and we messed up, and we're terrible to him, and he's terrible to us, and, you know, it's a very mutual being terrible to each other type situation. But this guy is on our side, and you need to trust him.
Yeah.
You need to do this.
And telling them, too, like, you know, don't just judge your dad based off of this one memory, like, because they're saying, like, yeah, no, we don't stand by what your dad did, and if your dad were here today, he would also tell you that wasn't the right way to treat Snape. He should have been better.
Yeah.
And so Sirius, it's like, yeah, he's been a turd. He's been a punk. But overall, I do feel like he is learning from his mistakes.
Yeah. And okay, so another part that I cried at.
Mm-hmm.
So Harry is back in Dumbledore's office. And they've just fought, you know, Voldemort and whatnot.
Yeah.
And yeah. Dumbledore just turns part of a statue into a portkey, and all of a sudden he's just in Dumbledore's office by himself for like 30 minutes and just grieving and fuming, angry, all these things. And Dumbledore's like, you know, like, tell me how you're feeling. And he's just like, I don't want to talk about how I feel. All right. And Dumbledore goes, Harry, suffering like this proves that you are still a man. This pain is part of being human. And Harry goes, then I don't want to be human. And he, like, just destroys, like, so much of Dumbledore's office, is just, like, throwing things. And he just goes, I've had enough. I've seen enough. I want out. I want it to end. I don't care anymore.
Yeah.
And that part just, like, so broke me, because, one, that's not true. You do care. You do, like,
yeah,
and that's the reason why you're reacting like this. But, like, this kid has been through so much, so much. Every single year of his life is marked in tragedy from the very beginning.
Yeah.
You know, every year at the Dursleys sucked. Every year at Hogwarts, he's like experienced higher highs than ever before, and also the lowest of lows. And he just keeps on having these absolutely awful experiences, and it's like, yeah, can I just not be this anymore? Yeah. And then he hears about the prophecy, because Dumbledore is like, I have to tell you now.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, I kind of messed up, because, like, I didn't want to tell you your first year, you were so young, and then your second year you just survived and you were Voldemort again, and you were still so young, and then your third year, like, you were attacked by Dementors and you were in the hospital, and I just didn't really feel like doing that to you. And then last year, Cedric died, and I didn't really have a moment to do this, you know? And here we are at the end of another year, and I didn't help you at all by not telling you that neither can live while the other survives.
And I have to tell you, because, yeah, now you're 15 at this point, and it's like, you have to know. You're old enough to know. And Voldemort's already tried to kill you how many times? Like, yeah, this is what it is. And I feel like it really sets it up for the Half-Blood Prince, because up to this point, Dumbledore has been an ally to Harry and a mentor, and he's helped him out, but he has withheld this really important information. And so at the end of this book, like, he tells him about the prophecy, and that, you know, Harry is destined to battle it out to the death with Voldemort. Basically, like, if you're hoping to run away from Voldemort and get away from him and live a happy life, like, sorry, kid, that's not in the cards for you.
Yeah.
Hate to be the one to tell it to you, but here we are. And then we know in the next book, that's when he's going to find out about the Horcruxes. And so Dumbledore at this point has been, like, like kind of moderately helpful, but very hands-off in his approach with Harry. And so I feel like this is kind of the book that bridges that gap where it's like, okay, now I've given you some information. And then at the end of the next book, we know like he's going to straight up go look for a Horcrux with mm-hmm. Dumbledore. And it's like, he's going to be kind of a peer.
Yeah. Well, I think before that, like Dumbledore is definitely like someone, you know, that is a mentor to some extent, mm-hmm. but like Dumbledore is pretty standoffish. He's kind of just like, I made sure that you got to this point. And I mean, he straight up says it in the book of like, you know, you arrived at Hogwarts as I planned, a little more malnourished, a little bit, you know, less loved than I would have liked.
That part which hurt my heart. Oh yeah. My God. Literally said malnourished.
Mm-hmm. And it just, I guess I had this moment of realization where it's like, yes, you're setting him up to like take on Voldemort, but then in another way, you're also kind of raising him to be a lamb to the slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
Like you've protected him up until this point, but you don't know what the outcome is going to be, but you do know something later on. Harry can't live.
Yeah.
At the same time as Voldemort, like literally the prophecy, but like you are going to have to die at some point.
Yeah.
And like that just is really heartbreaking to kind of have this thought of like Dumbledore has to make the hard decision of mm-hmm. like, I have to raise you, I have to make sure you're okay to this point. And then at some point, I can't do that for you anymore. I can't ensure your safety because that might not be an option. That's not
something I can do. Yeah. And this is a tangent that I'll try and just say in 30 seconds. But Dumbledore also, I don't think he trusts himself to have like strong, healthy relationships with people.
Oh, he sucks at relationships.
I mean, we know that later, like with his sister and his brother and Grindelwald. Mm. And it's like, so Dumbledore, I think, has this fear of like getting close to people because he knows that like when he gets close to people, sometimes really bad things happen. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, as a way to kind of protect Harry, I think he's like, I don't want to get super close to Harry because I'm not good at that. You know, I have a bad history, a bad track record of protecting the people that I care about.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Tangent. We'll talk more about that in the future books.
Yeah, we will. But basically, yet again, the fifth Harry Potter book, Order of the Phoenix, is my absolute favorite.
Okay.
Sets up so much.
It sets up so much.
And I mean, like, the next one might beat it for me, I would be very surprised. I've really locked in on the Order of Phoenix.
We'll see.
Like since it came out in 2003, like this has been the book to beat for me.
This has definitely moved up the ranks. I don't remember exactly where it was in my initial ranking. Half-Blood Prince is my favorite, so I'm so excited. I'm probably gonna start reading it tonight. Like I finished Order of the Phoenix right before we started recording this because spoiler alert, Edie read the book way faster than me, and I'm the one who's really having a hard time keeping up, which is what I said, I think, in episode one, that I was probably going to struggle to keep up, and I am. But I really liked Order of the Phoenix, even more than I was expecting to. The next book, I think, is my favorite, and I'm
which
just,
is also, oh, like, so much backstory. Like,
so much backstory.
This is, like, the backstory to the backstory, so then you can make sense of the backstory.
Yes.
You know, like, that's where I feel like the Order of the Phoenix is, which is why it's a little bit more, like, I don't know, like, walking through, like, why is the only word that's coming to my mind, like, oatmeal? But if you're just, like, walking through, or, like, water if you're in a pool, you know, it's,
resistance.
Like, it's there's so much resistance, but you gotta get there, and it's, like, mm-hmm. good and great. But it's not an easy, necessarily, read, you know? There are parts of it that seem a little bit more dull, but, like,
I didn't have that issue okay. with this book this time around.
I don't think it's dull, but
I know other people do. I did not think it was dull. It kept my attention the entire time. It starts off strong. I felt like the first chapter wasn't as annoying as some of the other first chapters.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, by the end, it was that like manic energy of like, oh my God, the next page. Okay, the next page. Okay, the next page. Like I have to know what's going to happen, even though like big picture, I did know what was going to happen, but I forgot about a lot of the smaller details. So this was an absolute page turner for me.
I think that the beauty in this book is that you're coming off of the fourth book, which is like a lot is happening the last couple of, well, mm-hmm. I mean, the whole book is like action, action, action.
Yeah.
And then the last couple of chapters is like, holy moly, Voldemort is back, Cedric is dead, Barty Crouch Jr. was actually Mad-Eye Moody,
yeah.
and there's just like so many like big things, just like bam 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 bam, and then you just start off and it's like you're at Privet Drive and you have no information and you don't know what's happening, and that's where you're at.
Yeah.
So it's like you come like full speed to like a grinding halt. And then it just kind of like builds a little bit more
mm-hmm.
of like, we know something's happening, but we don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's why I enjoy it. It's yeah. a break in the pace for me.
Okay.
To then set it up for Half-Blood Prince, which is very, very quick paced, I feel like.
Okay. I haven't read it in a while, so we'll see. But I really enjoyed Order of the Phoenix.
Yeah.
And I'm super excited to watch the movie. That'll be our next episode. Order of the Phoenix is my favorite Harry Potter movie.
Yeah.
At least it was in my ranking before we started the podcast. So we'll see if it stays there. I don't think anyone is going to top like the introduction of Luna Lovegood and Bellatrix Lestrange for me.
Oh, Bellatrix is so good.
So good. And the actress and that they got to...
Helena Bonham Carter.
Well, I know her name.
Okay.
Umbridge.
Sorry. Sorry, you're talking about Bellatrix. I'm just going to make a, you know, crazy leap to the actress who plays Bellatrix.
Okay. But this is true. And I forget everyone's name always, but I will never forget Helena Bonham Carter because I'm obsessed with her. But no, the actress that they got to play Dolores Umbridge is also...
She is excellent.
Delightful.
And we're going to talk so much about that in our next episode.
Yes,
so,
we are.
So, you know, like and subscribe. Leave us a review. You can do that on Spotify.
You can.
You can follow us at The Basic Cinephile on Instagram. On Twitter at The Basic Cinef 1. That's Cinephile without the I-L-E and the number 1. On TikTok at The Basic Cinephile. You can find us on the World Wide Web, basiccinephile.com, you know?
Yes, we post movie and TV reviews, not just Harry Potter content, but mm-hmm. also, because we're doing Harry Potter for our podcast, we also post a lot of Harry Potter content. This week, I posted one of my favorite reels I've posted in a while, and
so
it's only
good.
Got like 20 likes, so please pity me and go like it. It's just Snape strutting his stuff, and I'll leave it at that.
He looks good.
Honestly, I'm probably gonna make a bunch more of that same reel with just different songs. So yeah, you can follow us for Harry Potter content, for movie and TV reviews. We would love to hear from you guys, hear what you are enjoying about the podcast.
We love interacting, you know.
We just want to talk to other people who like talking about Harry Potter. And
yeah,
if you're listening to this podcast,
and books in general,
it's probably
so,
you.
Yeah.
New episodes come out every Thursday.
Woo woo.
And we will see you all next week.
Yeah. Have a good one.
Bye.
Bye.